I'd been sort of just within the world of music for a long time, and I wanted to somehow go out into the world and to experience it in dynamic and new ways and get information from different places, meet different people, see what people were thinking in different areas, challenge my own perspective on political points and human rights and all types of things. And, you know, if you help one other person, I mean, I don't really know much about what meaning is, but meaning for me is if one person is moved by one thing you do in some way that makes sense of my life and my journey. Sometimes you have to press record and see what happens.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
To musically capture the essence of a solo journey around the world sounds like a tremendous creative challenge to me. But musician, director, and photographer Jim Croft, my guest in this episode, has tackled it. His journey took him through the endless expanses of the Russian winter, but also into the loneliness of Chinese megacities. On the way, he saw with his own eyes how people fleeing terror in their home countries were washed up on the coasts of Europe. He processed the impressions of this journey in his project Journeys, which culminated in the album Love in the Face of Fear at the end of 2019. In the following conversation, I talked to him about his journeys, but also about how the creative process took place, how he transformed his experiences and the inspiration they provided into music. To get into the mood for the conversation, I suggest we listen to the title song of the album, Love in the Face of Fear. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for making the time.
Eric, absolute pleasure. And thank you for making time for me.
I would like to start our conversation by talking about the title song of your current album, Love in the Face of Fear. We have just listened to part of it. What is this song about and to whom is it directed?
Well, I set myself the challenge with this album, and that's the title track, Love in the Face of Fear. And I'd been traveling all over the world over the last 5 years, both as a musician touring around, but also with this broader project called Journeys. And it was really a sort of hope to finally bring my sort of whole artistic life under one umbrella, because I do a lot of filmmaking and juggle that with music and photography and some writing and so on. And I'd been just within the world of music for a long time. And I wanted to somehow go out into the world and to really sort of, you know, experience it in dynamic and new ways and get information from different places, meet different people, see what people were thinking in different areas, challenge my own perspective on political points and human rights and all types of things. And this was 5 years of work. And I came back to Berlin, and this was like just after I'd been in the US shooting a documentary on the rise of populism during the rise of Trump and his eventual election. And I remember sitting there in Berlin, and I was looking out and it was snowing and it was January 2017. And I realized I wanted to somehow compress everything that I'd felt and all these people I'd spoken, all these miles that I'd gone through, so many sort of, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands of miles. And I wanted to compress it somehow into a single idea. And it was very interesting because I've never suffered from writer's block. But for about this of the next month, I wouldn't even call it writer's block, but it was, you know, it was snowing a lot. And I was just sitting with this panoramic and I had this sense of, where do you start? How do you compress all of this human experience? You know, there's this great line in Steppenwolf's, in Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf, and it's at the last, the Steppenwolf must take the whole world into his heart. You know, this idea of somehow embracing everything. And I was very much thinking about, with the idea love in the face of fear, how does one connect ideas that don't want to go together? How does one embrace the duality of being alive, the splintering of political reality, this modern sense that we cannot communicate? And when my mind eventually settled on the idea of love as the great connector, it just hit me, that sort of love in the face of fear. You know, what is my own response to all this madness, all this division, all this violence and inability to agree and oppression of the other and fear of the other? So love in the face of fear was really, I mean, you could call it a slogan, but I think that's sort of not a tidy way of describing it. It's about trying to unify everything that I felt that I'd gone through, if you like.
Which is a very ambitious goal, right? After so many miles traveled.
Exactly. And I think that's why, you know, at the start of writing this album, I just had to take a sort of a long break and let, you know, and you forget this power of silence and this power of just, you know, of not doing anything. And, you know, there's this lovely quotation. It's like, if, you know, if you go out, you know, traveling in the world, you see difference. But when you stay at home, you see change. And I really felt that it took this time in the sort of early months of 2017 to really just introject and let all of these ideas and thoughts and experiences settle.
So as we can already hear in these answers, it is an ambitious project. It's about anger and hatred and division, but of course also about, as you have said, about love and all that connects us in the modern world. What did you try to, maybe the question is even wrong because maybe it's not the purpose of a project like this to accomplish anything specific instead of just expressing yourself in an artistic way, but let me still try to ask the question. So did you try to take stock of the situation that you have, or the situations that you have encountered all over the world, that you try to describe and portray, or did you also try to provide a specific message, like some kind of encouragement, for example?
It's a good question. And that for me, the album was very much, you know, I'd made 5 documentaries, you know, full feature length documentaries on different parts of the world, different subjects. And I wanted the album to be something that was a connector of ideas. So the album itself, you know, it's not sort of name specific. It's not person specific. It's much more a sort of emotional grappling of the totality. And I think in that way that different people, you know, affect your life, affect your heart, affect your thinking. And, you know, I mean, I can just sit here in this moment and I can think of different people. I can remember a very tall Rwandan man called Giza, who sort of changed the course of my long tour through East Africa. And, you know, I ended up sort of traveling with him to Uganda and experiencing all types of things there. I could remember sort of randomly walking into a pizza joint in Cleveland, in Ohio, when I was exploring the Rust Belt during the US election, and meeting a wonderfully named man called Stutz Beerkatz. And Stutz sort of took me all around the sort of the old deserted factories of Ohio, and, you know, and showed me, you know, what he called the sort of skeletons of American capitalism. And it was a very powerful experience because it started sort of making me understand you know, some of the reasons why people were gravitating towards Trump, who, you know, he was tapping into these, you know, these ideas like the exit of manufacturing from these, you know, from places like the Rust Belt, or, you know, a lot of the places I went in the US, you know, you go through a lot of these sort of old relic towns, these ghost towns where, you know, which were sort of all dependent or dependent on some industry that's, you know, manufacturing industry that's been outsourced. So, you know, so there were these different things, you know, and I could think of different people I've met literally in all over the world. Those are just two examples that flash before my eyes. But I wanted to, you know, I think the sort of, you know, for me, the role of music, of course, it's dependent on the artist and the artist's experience. Because, of course, you know, a song can be wonderful and lyrical and specific and, you know, and explore this type of sort of human day-to-day poetry. But I was sort of like really, I felt like I'd done that work with the specifics in the documentaries. And so I was trying to find something more universal, something that could just open a feeling up. And that's what I love about music, is, you know, providing the unique color it has, which is different to, you know, a novel or to a documentary or any of the other wonderful art forms we're lucky enough to have.
And of course, I would like to get into some of the specifics that are also part of your documentaries. But first, let's take a little step back and let me ask you, where did your passion for music actually come from? How did you start to develop your interest in music and also the understanding of music and its purpose that it has for you personally?
Well, I think sort of like many people, you know, when we're young, sort of music makes a sort of indelible impression upon you. And, you know, like many sort of, I got into music, I would say sort of, you know, sort of quite young, and I was a huge grunge fan, you know, and I think I was 13 when Kurt Cobain killed himself, and absolutely devastated. And but even much younger than that, you know, I remember, like, I grew up in a little town called Brechin in the north of Scotland. And I remember sort of discovering Little Richard, and I just couldn't believe this sound. And that sort of led to, you know, finding other artists, you know, like the Beatles or Nina Simone. And, you know, like you are, you know, it's not like Spotify where everything, you know, everything's available nowadays. You know, it's like, you know, of course, back then, the lovely thing was, you know, you're discovering fragments from your parents' LP players, or going down to Woolworths and kind of buying some cassette for $3.99 that's on special offer. And that's how I found the Beatles. But I'd never even thought about becoming a musician myself. It was just, for me, it was like something that these wizards did, you know, these magicians. Mm-hmm. But I did want to be a writer. So I was always sort of like pulling in, you know, feeding from different ideas and writing a lot. And when I was 18, 19, my mother became sick with terminal cancer. And this was my sort of first experience with truly coming across sort of, you know, death in such a way. And so we shared this experience together of the, you know, the end of her life. And of course, when someone has terminal secondary cancer, you know, they know that they have an end before them. So it's a huge experience for them, and also for, you know, for a child, you know, to go through. And this experience with mortality, it was after Mum died, I didn't know how to express this experience of mortality. Was such a sort of, it was like, what idea can you have to confront mortality? How do you cope with mortality? You know, especially as a young person, and, you know, you have no real sense of, you know, that life is limited at this early stage, you know, unless you've really gone through it. And of course, our society doesn't teach you about the ways in which we die or that death exists at all. And, you know, I didn't feel right writing. It was just suddenly it wasn't there. But there was this old battered guitar, and I picked it up, and I just started howling, you know, and just, it was just, you know, very, very basic. And, you know, I had no training, no musical training, but something about this capacity to really express your emotions cathartically and to dig into your deeper most center and just make noise, you know, because it's like, you know, music when you're in pain is pre, you know, it's pre-thought. It's much more visceral. It's at the bottom of your being. And that was why I love Kurt Cobain's music or John Lennon's music. Because, you know, the great soul singers, you know, like, you know, Little Richard, because they're just coming from that, from, you know, a source that kind of feels like you're, but beyond the scope of your own life. And when you feel that, that gravitas in your being, which an experience like sort of death can kick in, you know, it's very powerful and it's life changing. And, you know, I think apart from that, I never felt sort of quite, you know, like a, I never found a way to quite fit in. And I just, you know, I felt, you know, it felt sort of like I was carrying a lot of damage when I was growing up. And I just couldn't imagine to, you know, to be someone, to spend my life in a sort of office environment. I was always afraid that my sort of inner reality would be somehow discovered by being in these kind of like very socially structured environments. And, you know, what I was going through was just so full of depth and pain, not just in relation to my mother's death, but, you know, also, you know, different experiences growing up that really colored how I was to be in the world. And, you know, so going into my early 20s, I felt very, very damaged as a human being and, you know, was going through a lot of anxiety and, you know, panic attacks, feeling very alienated from, you know, my peers and the rest, you know, of society. And that, you know, of course, when you feel those things, it drives you further in. And I would say that in some ways, my musical journey, you know, for that first decade, if you like, was really about a journey towards sort of mental health and, you know, becoming healthier as a human being and working through the sort of profound experiences that I was having with panic attacks and anxiety and, you know, these questions of how one could and can be in the world when inside, you know, you're feeling fucking barking. You know, so yeah
that's a good question. How can one be in the world if you feel like that? And as a matter of fact, of course, you have been literally in the world for a big portion of your life. You have traveled a lot. Does that relate somehow to each other, the challenges that you coped with as a young person and your desire, your interest, or maybe your urge to travel, to get maybe to get away from where you were potentially, but also to explore different places? How did you start your passion for travel?
Well, I mean, very, very much so, because I think that my experience with, you know, with the things that I went through when I was younger, which included my arrival sort of in Berlin, which was a very, very difficult period of my life when I first moved over to Berlin in 2007. And it was a very raw period, a very uncertain period. But I was very, very lucky. You know, one of the huge and most profound effects of my life was finding, you know, having the courage at this young age. Oh, the courage is the wrong word, but I think the sort of some type of fundamental will to health inside myself that wanted to be healthy, that wanted to overcome the sort of the profound darkness that I felt within myself, you know, that was intermingled and expressing itself in this profound anxiety. And I went on this journey as, you know, as a human being, as a patient in therapy, as as a musician, as a young artist. And something I noticed was that, you know, I felt sometimes that, you know, within the society that I was living, that there was a sort of, I felt like there was a sense of stagnation. I was living in London by this stage. And I felt very often like it was as if there was a spiritual stasis in people. And so whereas I was feeling so fragmented and like I had a sense of who I was and what the components of me were, but I didn't have that deeper most inner point to, you know, to what the Zen Buddhists call the face that you have before you were born, you know, or the psychotherapists call the potential true self. I just didn't have contact to that because I was too damaged. But as I sort of went through my life and started becoming healthier, you know, I realized that I was in a very, very dynamic space. You know, one of the you know, of course, there's a certain joy as you feel yourself slowly over the years, and it is a slow process becoming healthier. But the more you become healthier, the more you link to life, and the more you have this capacity to make healthy connections. But I also felt this profound empathy, you know, to what was going on in the world and what was happening. And married to this sense of empathy and worry was this huge frustration of this sense of being outside history, you know, looking at the events that were happening. And you know, and I'd always been very idealistic when I was growing up. And I believed that music could be a way to, you know, to effect change, to make change, which I still believe, you know, I still believe passionately in the role of the arts. But at some stage, it wasn't enough for me. And I felt like I needed to go out and I needed to witness things and I needed to see it for myself. And so, you know, this combination of finding, you know, let's call it an existential foothold in myself, you know, this sense of feeling a health inside myself, but also this curiosity, because the healthier I got, the more I started thinking about, you know, and connecting and feeling things like sort of, you know, the lives of refugees, the idea of human rights, you know, what are the homeless going through? How does, you know, greater sort of political reality affect the individual? Why, you know, but also philosophical questions, you know, why does man lust after power? You know, how can men, and I say men because, you know, it has been so often men in history who've just fucked things up so consistently, you know, and, you know, there's, of course, there's wonderful things in society, and I'm certainly not a man hater, but I really kind of went out and I was like, you know, I was like, well, where are the new ideas? You know, how can we confront, you know, this terrible precipice that we've come across? And simply put, at this point in music, it just wasn't enough for me. I also had to revitalize my own experience of the world to say something different sort of musically. I wanted to find a way to really feel that I could culturally connect and be a part. And in order to do that, I had to dig in far deeper and open myself up to realms far beyond my own story. And really, the gift that health gave me was the capacity to not be any more dominated by my own damage, and to interject and to feel and to have the curiosity to converse with other people and other ideas. And that includes not just, you know, people who are having a hard time or suffering, but it includes embracing people that have different ideas to how I think, people across the political divide, people whose ideas that I could never conceive or think of, and thinking, how can bridges be built between, you know, people that think so differently? And that's actually like why the last film, the documentary, which I just recently finished on the US election, is called A Conversation with America, because I realized that if we cannot have conversation with one another without, you know, shouting each other down, you know, we will never be able to listen. And, you know, like if you've been through something like therapy, you know, through psychoanalysis, you know, you realize it's about exchange. It's about the communion and the communication between two people. It's as much about speaking as listening. And you cannot go through that spiritual development without the other.
You have mentioned that you spent some time in London. You went to Berlin in 2007, where you, as far as I know, also in the beginning lived in an art community in a house without water and electricity, which I'm sure was also a very special time for you, very inspiring time, informative time. And yeah, you just already hinted at many aspects and facets of what I believe eventually led to the project of Journeys, right? All these questions that came to your mind through the experiences in London, Berlin, and of course, all the thoughts that were growing in your own head and in your own mind. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about a journey as an project in itself. So how did you come up with it, and what is the essential idea behind it?
Thank you for sort of raising the context of Berlin, because the experience of living in Germany and living in Berlin, and, you know, and those early years being in and around the Tacklers arts community, and you know, meeting so many of these amazing artists, because when the wall came down, you know, it wasn't, you know, of course, people always talk about how many people went east to west. But as a result of this, you know, you had so much empty space in East Berlin. And, you know, and even when I arrived back in 2007, you had so much empty space. And much of this empty space was occupied by artists from West Berlin who were, you know, went over to the east side. And, you know, and took over spaces and these amazing buildings like the Tacklers, which, you know, was built in, you know, 1909, and which was, you know, the Tacklers was originally a massive Arcadium, and it was, you know, shopping center and all the rest of it. And then it was taken over by the Nazis, used for administration. After the Second World War, it was bombed, or was it actually just before that? was bombed and that it was using a DDR, and all around that area you had all the listening posts. And then of course when the wall came down, you had the artists coming from west to east. So I arrive in Berlin, you know, with literally, you know, and like I my whole life in this van and nothing to go back to. And you know, I'm squatting with my bandmates at the time just around the corner from the Tackless Arts community, like literally, like you could look out the back of our window onto the arts community. And we were like, you know, we arrived in this building and it was absolutely freezing, and you know, we were walking around, it was completely sort of like, you know, completely empty, such, you know, some trash, there'd been other squatters there over the years, but it was basically completely empty. And you know, you're talking about the most prime real estate in all of Germany, in the center of, you know, of the east side of Berlin, intersecting, you know, just up the road from Bahnhof Friedrichstrasse, and intersecting Friedrichstrasse and Oranienstrasse. And of course, at the time, I had no idea about how mesmerically poetic this experience was, because at the time I was just cold and thinking, you know, what the hell am I doing with my life? You know, what am I doing here? And kind of feeling again, you know, and I hadn't felt like, you know, that this deep anxiety for a few years, but I was like, really, this is a heavy experience. And I remember just going into the Tackleys, and there was this man with his shining eyes called Paolo, and he was a member of the arts community, and he brought over a Hefeweizen. And I remember sort of our drummer Matt saying, taking his first sip and just saying, ah, the doom is lifting, like this. And that was our first experience of German Hefeweizen, which was a religious experience. It was a sort of road, Paul on the road to Damascus discovering Hefeweizen. And but you know, so these were amazing years, and my whole life, you know, I never left Berlin. Berlin is in every single part of me. And you know, this experience of the community was made in a profound effect upon me. And of course, as a musician, you know, we were playing like three times a week then. We were playing up in White Trash, which is another very, very famous Berlin location. You know, and these gigs were going on all night. We were playing three sets a night, you know, and you had everyone coming down from, you know, you had DJs coming down, models with drug dealers coming down. You know, it was, and everyone was like, who are these crazy guys from England, these rock and roll people? And it was an electro city, because, you know, I mean, obviously, like since then, you know, pop and rock has, you know, it's got absolutely massive singer-songwriters. But we were a bit of a curiosity, at least in Berlin back then. And we were, you know, people were very curious about these squatting people from the aisle, as they used to say. And but anyway, so you know, I had this experience then, and then I eventually left the band because it got very, very self-destructive and a wonderful time, but as beautiful things tend to do, it sort of absolutely destroyed itself in a sort of like chaos and inferno of the ways that human beings break down beautiful things. And so I then went out into the underground, started again and playing a lot of gigs as a solo artist, made my way back up. And eventually, by this stage, it got to 2013, and I sort of like, you know, I was over 30 by this stage, and I secured a record deal with EMI, which was a sort of defining moment of my sort of, you know, culmination of my sort of young musical life, if you like. And you know, and EMI sort of, you know, put me on buses all around Europe, and it was a fantastic time because, you know, suddenly you've got the opportunity to be, you know, on nightliners and the rest of it, and you're playing festivals and you're really feeling like you've made it. But of course, no one told me back then that EMI was totally broke. So my record, Lunatic Lullabies, comes out Friday the 30th of March, which is in 2013. And I always remember the date because it was my birthday and I played a gig and it was sold out. And it was a fantastic night. And, you know, of course, it's Berlin and you play a sold out gig at the, you know, the old Magnet Club, now Music and Freedom. And you go out and you spend the whole weekend absolutely hammering it. And I wake up on the Monday morning and I get a call from my manager, Jasper. Hey, Jim. Hey, Jasper, how you doing? Jim, you know, you've got no record deal anymore. And I was like, what the hell are you saying, man? The record came out on like Friday. And he goes, yeah, sorry, man, you've lost it. EMI's been bought by Universal. And I'm like, I'm sitting there with the worst three-day hangover, being in Berghain and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, well, that's great. You know, this was the culmination of my musical life. And, you know, and it turns out I was the last artist to ever, you know, to ever release an album on the old EMI. You know, so, you know, this great label of the Beatles and Radiohead and Eric Clapton and the rest of it signed off with this sort of stillborn album, Lunatic Lullabies. There you go. And, you know, and then this strange thing happened. I got this invitation to go and play some shows in the States. The album, you know, actually sort of took, you know, got some traction, even though there was no money going into it. And so I went over without my record deal over to the US. And then there was this, played this gig in LA. And then there was this crazy Russian guy there. And he comes up to me and he introduced me. He goes, "Yeah, Jim." And I, hey, man. And he's like, "Yeah, you will come over and you will play in Moscow and you will support my band, Mummy Troll." And I'm like, "Right. Okay, no problem. I will come over and I'll play with you, with this band, Mummy Troll." Never heard of Mummy Troll. No one tells me anything about this band. So I head over with the band. They pay very well. We head off into Moscow. And there's this huge, enormous university that Stalin built. And so we arrive there. I'd been thinking we were going to be playing in some dungeon in the middle of, you know, in Moscow. And we go up, we sound check. It's quite a big stage. And I'm thinking, cool, there might be a few hundred people here. We go upstairs. And we spend, you know, we're drinking beers upstairs, thinking we should play a little university. Go down, the 7,000 people outside in front of the stage. Not for us, of course, but we find out it's for this band, Mummy Troll. And it turns out they're the biggest band that sort of have ever been in Russia. Now, no one told me that. So we're out there on this stage hammered, but the students aren't noticing how drunk we are. They're just loving that there's music going on and they're absolutely smashing it. And after the gig, we just go out and have this wonderful time with the Russians. And, you know, and they're just, we just have this incredible time, end up going over to Vladivostok on the other side. And I just realized there was something going on and I was getting these different invitations despite having lost this record deal. I had an invitation to go and play in China. And I just thought, right, I'm just going to take the opportunity for this tour that I was offered in China over 6 weeks. By this company called Splitworks, which is a Chinese booking agency. And so I went over there and I started, and I just thought I'd take the opportunity to make this film. So the strange thing was, is that the whole Journeys project kind of came out of this culmination of this moment in my life with my big moment that I'd worked, you know, for 10 years towards, and, you know, just feeling so devastated about losing this deal. And then I just thought, and you know, you either give up or you go back to the drawing board. And I just thought, no, this is my opportunity to redefine myself as an artist altogether. And, you know, so it was kind of out of that sort of personal, destruction of what I thought was the sort of end of my musical life that actually ended up enabling all of the most important experiences of what I would call my adult life, if you like.
And these experiences have been so versatile because, in fact, the project Journey turned out to be you more or less traveling on all continents mm-hmm. and turning these travels and these experiences into different kinds of songs and EPs, right?
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think this is the thing, is that, you know, you never know what is going to trigger the change in your life. And I think that one of the things we all experience as human beings is that, you know, we have times of profound stuckness, you know, and how do you say that in German? Is verfahren zu sein, would you say?
yes, you can say that.
Does that work? Or is that?
Yeah, definitely. Verfahren. Yeah. Die Situation ist verfahren. Or festgefahren.
Oh, festgefahren, like, really. Lovely. Yeah, yes. Which is a very lovely word as well. And, you know, and the quality of this is that, you know, you think that you are never going to emerge, you know, and, you know, and of course, this is, you know, one of the things, characteristics, you know, when you feel like, you know, you're kind of, you know, some people start thinking they're mentally ill or whatever, you know, and it's a little bit of a problem that I have, because so often sort of mental illness is used as a terminology for things that are actually like thresholds that we must go through and we have to experience as human beings, and we almost inevitably will experience. You know, you think of the sort of opioid crisis in the US, you know, and you think, you know, of drugs being prescribed or administered, you know, to compensate or alleviate or deviate or change or affect or improve, inverted commas, improve, or to suppress emotion. And it's like, well, you know, like, but these emotions are the very things that provide us the challenge to evolve as human beings, to emerge into ourselves, to react to. And it doesn't make it easier when you're going through them. But, you know, if there's something that I'd like, one of the things I'd like to try and put out through my work is to have some type of acceptance about where you find yourself at this point in time. You know, Nietzsche talked about it, about this acceptance of your fate, you know, of this acceptance that this moment right now is exactly where you were meant to be. It's not a coincidence. It is precisely that that is your challenge. And I've been through that, you know, like us all, many, many times in my life. And, you know, and I think there were certainly times in my life when I, you know, like I could have been or would have been administered all types of stuff. And it, you know, it makes sort of the hair on the back of my neck stand up, because like for me, it has been those depths of emotions that have enabled eventually triggers to growth. Now, that can come from anywhere. And, you know, and sometimes the world helps you as well. You know, often these inner journeys, they, you know, we have to find our own, navigate our own way through our own pain, our own past and our own experience. But also, you know, it's like that sort of Joseph Campbell, you know, talks about the sort of the hero's journey, you know, at different times, especially, you know, it's sort of Skywalker when he has to go into the cave to confront Darth Vader, who's not actually Darth Vader. You know, he's a shadow of himself. You know, you have to confront those archetypes to, you know, and be confronted by the darkest things in us. And quite often, right when you come to that point, you know, you find a guide or an angel, or life gives you a little push along. And I think for me, you know, I certainly think that, I mean, I can't quite believe the sequence of events that led to the Journeys project.
Which is actually, if I may just intersect, please, a pretty common, right? Or the common challenge that we often face is that you mentioned the obstacles that we sometimes feel we almost right. cannot overcome, but that are actually the very thing that we do have to push through in order to achieve whatever, the next step in our life. And in the moment, it's very hard to recognize these obstacles as what they are. They can also be a stepping stone. Just if we look back onto our lives, onto the past decades, we see there's a red thread. And in hindsight, it very often looks very obvious and makes so much sense. But it's very hard to have the faith and the trust that the same will apply for our future, that things, one thing will lead to another, most of the times at least.
Well, exactly. And I think that's right. And I think, you know, like, you know, that there is a continuum of space and time that we live in. And when you're stuck and when you're feeling in pain and when your mind is circling, or when you're having a panic attack, or if you're in, you know, some type of sense of internal convulsion, no matter what it is, because there are so many versions of this, you know, you just don't think you're ever going to find your way. And, you know, and thank you for mentioning the song Obstacles, you know, from the new album, because, you know, that is sort of, that song is trying to sort of spiritually engage with, you know, with this idea that, you know, I think there's a lyric, if I remember, like, you know, looking at the dam that I got to breach, it is high and hard to reach. You know, it's this kind of sense that the obstacles feel insurmountable. And, you know, this is when the idea of faith comes in, you know, and I don't mean faith in a religious term, but I mean, it can be a religious terminology. It doesn't, for me, it's not really important whether, you know, like wherever you take your hope from in life, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's yoga or trying to do one positive thing in the day to move yourself forward, or speaking to a friend or reaching out. But it's like, how do we find a way, you know, to move up those slopes, you know, and they really are slopes sometimes, but you know, you have to keep confronting. And, you know, there's this sense of faith, I think, is, you know, it's just so important. And I love what you said, Eric, about looking back, because, you know, this is why it feels so important for me to try and express this in my life, because I've now lived enough life that I can have a faith when those moments come back, and when I feel like life is re-breaking me, which it does. You know, life always comes to test you anew. But I've been through those experiences enough that I know that there are phases that you go through. And the paradox being is that, you know, once you've been humbled by life enough, that's how you learn the tools, you know, like the little bits of wisdom or tools or crutches or knowledge that help you through the next one. And, you know, and I think, you know, this is one of the things, you know, as sort of, you know, through journeys, through having experienced so much, is to pass on a little bit about sort of what I've experienced in the world in the hope that maybe it might help someone else. And, you know, if you help one other person, I mean, I don't really know much about what meaning is, but meaning for me is if one person is moved by one thing you do in some way, that makes sense of my life and my journey.
Okay, on that note, I think it would be great if we actually talk a bit about some of the experiences you have made during this project journeys, which, as we have already mentioned, is a huge project. It consists of several CDs, it consists of movies, and of course, it consists of many years of travels and experiences. So the best we can do right now is just to give a little glimpse, but I would just give you a few prompts and let's see where it leads us. For example, as far as I know, you have traveled Africa quite a bit. When was that?
So I headed over to East Africa, and again, this was sort of another chance meeting that led me over there, because I have a friend who's in publishing, and he's called Lucas Pizon, and he connected me to this wild-eyed, and it was hard to tell where he was from, because he was, you know, he's basically part Italian, part German, and, you know, but I sort of met him, and he was this ball of energy, and he sort of spoke in some sentences that it's hard to describe. Like, sort of, you know, when you meet someone and their sentences are going in five different directions at the same time, and his name was Mark Dealer, and he was an old sort of, you know, well, not old, he wasn't so much younger than me, but older than me, but he was sort of a sort of, you know, he used to be sort of an anarcho-punk, if you like. And, you know, he sort of, you know, experienced all types of squattings and, you know, like extraordinary experiences. And then I think at some stage, if I remember, you know, he kind of found himself sort of broke, and he just thought, I'm going to get out of Europe. And he sort of, you know, headed down to East Africa. And then he made his way, made a new life there. And he runs this extraordinary sort of guest house on the beaches of Zanzibar, and it's called Red Monkey Lodge, and this is, you know, this is famous all over like East Africa, and you have some of the best musicians from all over Africa coming to play at Red Monkey Lodge that he and his wife Christine run. And he said, you know, and again, it was sort of like in this kind of like imperative type of thing. It's a bit like this when I met this extraordinary Russian man, and you know, and he just said, he's just like, Jim, you're going to come and play a residency at Red Monkey Lodge, and it's going to be great. And I was like, all right, let's do it like this. And so I headed over there, and, you know, and he set up this tour, you know, all around sort of East Africa. And it was just an extraordinary sort of backbone to meeting so many different people, you know, musicians and just regular people that you kind of come across, and trying to kind of construct a little sense of, you know, what life is like in this extraordinary part of the world.
Another part of the world that you traveled quite extensively is Russia. Specifically, you took the Trans-Siberian Express and turned the experiences that you've made there, besides others, into a movie, which is called The White Arrow. What was that experience like?
I think that one of the extraordinary things was, so after I'd been in Russia at the start of the Journeys project, I sort of realized that, you know, I started having a sense of how vast Russia was and how sort of extraordinary its people were, but also how misrepresented and misunderstood it is. And, you know, this is, of course, like, you know, before the sort of the Russian investigation and, you know, Russia being such a massive topic. This was in 2015, before the US presidential election. And I just, you know, I'd always been sort of very interested, particularly in the sort of characters of Dostoevsky and, you know, these sort of exploration of sort of, you know, good and evil, and the sort of the shades between good and evil, and it being sort of like these characters being sort of very non-linear, you know, human characters essentially. And I just felt like I wanted to somehow grapple with Russia. And I was also kind of quite intrigued, apart from my personal experiences and the great shows that I play there, but I was also kind of like quite curious to, you know, I wanted to go in winter, because I thought, well, the great armies of the world have been destroyed by the Russian winter. You know, Napoleon's army, of course, was, you know, nearly a million people devastated, you know, and then Hitler, you know, tried to have a go and, you know, to take over Russia. He didn't learn Napoleon's lesson. Exactly the same thing happened to Hitler, you know, and it's like, you know, the Russians were all, you know, they would be retreating, you know, from these armies, and they would just burn their homes. You know, they would burn their homes, they would burn their cities so that the invading armies would have nothing to rely upon. And they knew that once the winter, you know, this is old psychology, you know, they used, you know, it was the, you know, the Russians provided the gap between the Mongols coming over and actually taking over, like, you know, probably the whole world. So, you know, the Russians have this extraordinary depth of spirit, you know, this extraordinary stoicism, but you know, it's hard to get through because life is tough in Russia. You know, it's not an easy place to live. And so anyway, like, I think the sort of psychotic part of me thought, well, look, you know, I'm going to go and take this, you know, if I want to really understand Russia, I feel like I've got to go in winter. And if I'm going to understand Russia, I've got to go across the whole damn thing. So anyway, I started St. Petersburg, and I mean, I was working with a wonderful lad called Tim, who actually helped book booked the whole tour. Big shout out to Tim. We still call it the miracle. And you know, we booked this like 25 shows across Russia and all these different, you know, different cities. Now, the thing about the Trans-Siberian Express is that, you know, when you're going across the Trans-Siberian Express, you know, first of all, like, you know, in Russia in winter, I mean, you can't imagine how cold it is. So that's one thing that you're tackling with, you know. And it's like the shortest day that I went on one of these trips was 24 hours. And, you know, like the longest trip, I mean, there were like 5 24-hour trips. There was one trip that was 4 nights and 5 days in between Ekaterinburg and Novosibirsk. And, you know, so you're really getting inside the country. But one of the very curious things, if you're playing concerts, you know, every night, you've got a few things that you really have to factor in. You know, one thing is that, you know, the stereotype about Russia and vodka, it's really real. You know, they come after you before the gig, during the gig, after the gig, and then for the rest of the night, because they don't think the gig has stopped at all. And they are just making you, and they want to, they're like, they're all like, what is this crazy dude from Scotland doing in the middle of, you know, why are you in Novosibirsk? You know, why are you in Perm? Why are you in Khabarovsk or Komsomolsk na Amura? And they all have this question. It's like, what are you doing here? And then I'm like, I want to find out about Russia. And then they kind of, you know, having been so very cold at the start of the night, you know, they decide they love you. And if a Russian decides they love you, they take you into your heart forever. Now, the problem that comes with this is if you're going through Russia, you have 7 different time zones. Now, if you miss one of those trains, you know, you're not getting internal flights. You are missing the rest of the tour. So, you know, you can't wimp out and actually just stay in bed for an extra hour. You have to do that. And all while this is happening, you're really trying your best not to fall into the snow and fall asleep, because you're drunk in so much vodka and your phone's out of batteries and the Russians have all pissed off or passed out. So you're trying to get back to your apartment in these various cities across Russia. But somehow I managed to kind of like make my way across the whole of the continent. And it sort of climaxed in Vladivostok after a month of these insane gigs. And somehow the sort of press had got hold of this sort of Scotsman that was kind of coming across, you know, Russia, you know, drinking up its sort of winter supply of vodka. And these two bands came across in Vladivostok, and they made this super band. And these guys had learned all of the different songs from the different Journeys albums, and they started promoting this gig. And so we had this gig, I think there were like 500 people or 700 people or something crazy. And it was like, they had learned all the songs. So having been playing these sort of all these gigs with frozen hands across Russia with these pink gloves on in between, all of Vladivostok seemed to turn up to this gig, and it was literally one of the best nights of my entire life.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
It was a lovely experience. So I have the Russians deeply in my heart. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, sadly, Russia is only ever talked about through, you know, in terms of, you know, its political reality, its political classes, and, you know, and you know, and the terrible things that they do, especially, you know, there's terrible times, you know, for people who are gay or bisexual, you know, in Russia. It's a very, very hard environment to live in. You know, you have problems with, you know, invasion with, you know, in Crimea and so on.
And of course, yeah, Bob Mueller's Russia investigation you already mentioned. And you also describe in one of your texts that I read Russia more or less as one of the most misunderstood countries on earth, a country that is seen primarily, as we have just discussed, through the lens of political annexation and investigations from the Western perspective. And of course, it probably surely has its challenges, but you really wanted to try to see past and through these misunderstandings and find out the true nature, at least how you perceive it.
Well, I think this is the thing, and I think this is the paradox, is that, you know, and I spoke to young Russians about this, and they're like, you know, the problem is that they are coming up with their own dreams and their own takes on reality. Now, the thing is if they are always stereotyped, you know, through the machinations of what, you know, the government's doing, they are just eventually, you know, they become cynicized and they get warped and sort of taken into this kind of very sort of like dual version of history where, you know, where the old, you know, us and them is forever perpetuated. And, you know, the thing is that the Russian young guys and girls that I met, I mean, it just, they have their own dreams, their own culture, their own way of thinking. And it's, and I think it's very hard for them because they see that side of Russia is never expressed or understood. And so, you know, I feel that like, I feel that, that there's a really a different, softer and more sort of, you know, dreaming side of Russia that's reflected in the documentary. And I hope that that, you know, makes some type of contribution to the sort of cultural conversation.
So in terms, let's just stick with the term misunderstanding, like from my perspective, what we just mentioned is a matter of fact, the annexation of Crimea or the intervention, the influence of the American election, for example, all of this does take place. So what is, from your perspective, the misunderstanding?
Well, that's a very good question. I would say that it's about how newspapers are sold, you know, with, and I don't mean this critically of, you know, of the press. I have many of my great friends are journalists. And, you know, I, you know, if you go onto my Twitter, onto Facebook, you will see I stand with journalists is something, you know, it's a very important theme for me. But, you know, the thing is that like reality is non-linear. And the and it's just an interesting question because I think if you always sort of perpetuate the same dialogues, you know, and of course these media cycles, they, you know, they sell the newspapers. And of course, if I was a journalist, I'd be writing about the same type of thing. But there are sort of other realities going on and there's other potentials in those realities. And, you know, I do think it's the role of, you know, someone like myself, in my realm as a documentary filmmaker or for, let's say, other musicians to go and get over there and play in Russia. Obviously, it's a very hard time at the moment. So, you know, one has to factor that in. But, you know, people in the cultural realm have a role to play, you know, and if the political realm and the media realm is, you know, perpetuating these same myths, these say, not myths, because as you say, these are very real things that need to be reported. And, you know, the reporters reporting these things are very, very brave people. And sometimes, you know, they're putting their lives on the line for to report these stories. But I think there is a greater cultural heart of Russia. And, you know, and I think coming out of this comes the question, what is the role of the arts? And, you know, for me, it's I look back at when I lost my deal at EMI. And of course, I was devastated. But, you know, if you are, you know, living within the realm of music, you know, there are, how do I say, it was a relief to me in some ways to lose the deal because my musical life, you know, a musician's life can be quite limiting. You know, you get red carpets and awards and you're meeting other singer-songwriters, you're living within an artistic, you know, bubble. And don't get me wrong, I do appreciate me something. I made a film in 2017, which was actually based around the Reeper Barn Festival. And the name of that film, which was commissioned by one of the companies I work with, is Warum seid ihr so scheiße leise? And, you know, the title was taken from Visions magazine. It's like, why are you so fucking quiet? You know, and it was a challenge to the musicians to step up and step out. Now, in all fairness to the musical community, people are stepping up now and people are, you know, are lending their voice. But I think a big part of that is I think maybe people don't realize their own collective power within the arts, not just to speak up through their songs, but about where they choose to play. And, you know, it's important to stand up for other people. But it's also important to stand up for other cultures. You know, I get nailed by some people because I'm a lover of Russia, a lover of Russian people. And I'm quite loud about that. And that doesn't have to sit in contradiction with being very, very critical about what the political parties do.
And I think the very same applies for another major country, which is America, the USA, which you have done another major project about, a project that you also have already mentioned. It's called A Conversation with America. It's a documentary as well. And as far as I understand, you were driven kind of by the same mission in this case, right? You were driven by the wish, the desire to look past potential misunderstandings as well and to really understand very specifically how Americans think and how they make their decisions, what the state of America is, and that's the actual point where it's getting more specific, how someone like Trump could actually create this mass appeal. But I don't want to put words into your mouth, so maybe you talk about it. So what did you want to try to find out about the USA? Because you went in there before Trump won. So you talked to people there not knowing what the actual culmination would be like.
Well, exactly. I went over to America 3 months before the election started, and I was there on election night and in the aftermath as well. Now, I filmed a documentary called The March of Hope, exploring the lives of refugees and while in Europe. And I'd become sort of more and more aware about the division that was going on in Europe between the left and the right, and between the sort of, you know, how people sort of looked at vulnerable people. And I was incredibly sort of, you know, shocked both before I went on the journey to explore what was going on with refugees in Europe. I was shocked beforehand, but even more so when I was there, by this fact that we live on this profoundly wealthy continent, you know, Europe. And from what I see, there is just this profound complicity in allowing people to die on our waters. For me, it's just completely inexcusable. You know, it doesn't matter if you are the farthest right wing or the farthest left wing. You know, if you're politically central, it's just this. For me, there's just a total moral vacuum that, you know, people are being allowed to die on our waters. You know, that, you know, a basic humanity, let alone a human right, is that, you know, you help someone if they are in mortal danger. And, you know, it is a logistical challenge and all the rest of it. But, you know, at the moment, there's a lot of conversation about, you know, about colonialism and about statues and the rest of it. Well, there's no conversation that actually how much European life money, you know, was made through colonies and the rest of it. And yet when people are fleeing from war, from climate change, you know, from dictators, from, you know, or terrorism, whatever it may be, we cannot put a couple of ships on the water to go and at least rescue people. And, you know, whether or not you're sending them back, that's a different moral question. But for me, this idea of allowing people to die is just absolutely, you know, women and children, it's just reprehensible. But, and even worse is that there's a sort of moral neutrality about it. It's this sense that if you turn the eye, it doesn't exist, which I find even worse than actually recognizing your complicity in it, because at least that's honest. And I hate this moral vacuum that we seem to be living in here. And, you know, in one of the things I found, I was doing a fundraising campaign called The Boat for Sarah, which was to raise money for a search and rescue boat for a wonderful NGO called ProMade. And during this, I kind of started getting hammered by the right wing and, you know, kind of receiving sort of various sort of death threats and this type of stuff. And, you know, I was like, wow, this is, you know, it really brought home sort of the reality. I mean, I think we're probably even more aware of it now because populism is such, you know, it's become, you know, I mean, look, AfD is the opposition party in Germany. And, you know, you're talking Germany, you know, it's such a sign that the war, you know, that things have shifted, let alone sort of, you know, Trump and Erdogan and all the rest. But the thing was, what I felt, I was, so, and this was something that was coming more and more into my thought while I was filming The March of Hope. And, you know, when Trump started emerging, I've always been very, very interested in the US election, always follow it very closely. So when Trump emerged as the candidate, I sort of realized that you were never going to have a sort of a more sort of, I mean, I hate to use the word, but eloquent expression of a populist, you know, coming into power and someone who the right wing can gravitate around, you know, and someone like Trump, who's, you know, he's sort of kind of very pragmatic. I mean, you know, he sort of embraces positions just because it's useful to him. I mean, he doesn't, you know, people sort of like, I think, get lost in Trump as being this kind of like sort of evil dictator, like the sort of Stalins or Pol Pots or whoever it is. But, you know, I think Trump is a different type of character. He's a narcissist and he's out for himself. And I think he's a, you know, he's actually a very fragile man in a lot of ways in his ego. But I was just, so I was very, very interested about it. But so that was one side of it. It was this sort of interest in populism. But the other side being noticing, you know, like through the March of Hope and my own experience and, you know, reading the news and so on, it was just how I was so dumbstruck by how divided our society is becoming, how divided our conversation is, the polarity within our conversation, this inability to listen to one another. And the other thing I felt was, you know, there were all the sort of conversation from America. And, you know, this might sound like I'm sort of making a commentary post the event, but it was very much in my thoughts as I had this real thought. I don't feel like we're really hearing voices from anywhere other than the sort of coasts, you know, and it felt like, you know, that there was a media circus around the Trump rallies and, you know, around, you know, all the sort of the spectacle of American drama. And of course, the money's there with having the cameras at the, you know, the political rallies and following the sort of all the things going on in Washington. And I just thought, well, no, there's a story there and it's ready made. And if you're if you're into documentary, you know, and you're interested in trying to kind of get under the skin of what's going on in the world, I was like, there's just a story here. So I headed over and I had absolutely no contacts. And I sort of literally traveled, I think, about 8,000 miles sort of through sort of places. And, you know, I mean, I never came, you know, hardly across any of, you know, sort of pollsters or journalists in some of these funny little places that I went. And, you know, the film was very much about just trying to find out what normal people were thinking. And, you know, one of the lovely things about that is that, you know, you have your own assumptions challenged, because if you just read the news or, you know, like actually people just think that anyone that supports Trump, you know, are, in Hillary Clinton's words, out of a basket case of a basket of deplorables. But, you know, when I'm going through different states in New Mexico and Texas and Colorado and, you know, some places in the Rust Belt, you know, your doors are getting flung open by Trump supporters who are, you know, very, you know, can also be very hearty and homely people, and a lot of central conservatives and, you know, people with who, you know, do have very strong family values and, you know, love of nature as well. A lot of sort of ideas that, you know, like that are, you know, mutual ideas between the sort of left wing and the right wing, ideas that can connect people. And this was a lovely thing, was just to go there. And then, of course, you know, to ask the hard questions, you know, why are you voting, you know, for someone like, you know, Trump, saying the things that he says, you know, about other people or about women, you know, or about minorities, you know, the racist comments and, you know, and having the difficult conversations and trying to understand what are the whys behind it. And the problem is very often nowadays is that people don't want to listen, that there might be reasons behind the whys. You know, populism doesn't just come out of nowhere as half of humanity just being absolute nutters that want to sort of, you know, destroy stuff. And, you know, there's much deeper and more complicated social political works at play and emotions at play. And that doesn't mean that I don't think we need to be very, very, very worried about the rise of populism. But if we're ever going to get past this moment, it has to be to understand it from the inside and to have a conversation with the people that generate these political movements and understanding what their emotional reality is and what their intellectual reality is and how those things combine. And, you know, frankly, at the moment, it's just us and them. And the thing is, that's the stuff that leads to stuff like, you know, fascism. You know, that's what it leads to. And it's the lack of conversation. So we are all accountable. We are all a part of this. And if we think that it's just us and them, then we're playing into lessons from history we should have already learned.
What you are saying, yeah, makes me really think about like presidential candidate Biden. He likes to talk about this is a fight for the soul of this nation, which sounds very dramatic, but in some sense, that's absolutely true. But what you are telling us is really, yeah, to be careful to not mistake this fight for the soul of the nation for a war against an enemy that we have to somehow defeat and hate, but to somehow find a way to still have the inner power and will to listen and to try to understand empathetically what's going on quotation marks the other side. And I think this would be a whole conversation in itself to talk about what you found, why people gravitated towards Trump. Maybe we can have this conversation at some point of time. I would love that. Unfortunately, our time is almost up for this time. Of course, the best source to get these answers is your documentary. Can you remind me, when is it out?
Well, I've just finished it very recently, so it's going to be coming out in the film festivals quite soon. It's having a good run so far, just as I've started applying, and I'm hoping it'll come out before the election.
That would be good as a potential little impact towards what we just said, which leads me to my maybe last question. What is the impact that you hope to have with your work, both in terms of music and in terms of you as a documentary filmmaker?
Well, I think, this comes back down to, for me, back to the psychological journey of my own life and my own spirit, in that I think there are sort of twin realities in being a human, in that there is the relationship between being and between doing. And as I've got older, I've worked very hard to sort of accept myself for who I am and to define myself for who I am. So, I'm not, I am a musician. I am a documentary. Documentary is something I do. Film is something I do. They express my values, they express my heart, they express my soul, but my essence is within myself and it's expressed through those things, but it's within my being. And so when it comes to impact, I feel very philosophical about it because, I know that sort of like in the modern world and, every sort of blog post is about how how you reach all these people and you improve your life. And there's this sort of obsession with statistics. And for me, it just kind of passes me by, I want to do good work. And for me, the only statistic matters is the statistic of the human soul. And, is one person affected by one of those works in some ways? If one life is truly moved or changed or influenced or inspired, there is no way to measure that, because that, for me, there is that energy between us. That is everything. And, and of course, it's like if more people have that experience, that's a lovely thing. But, my sense with my work is keep going. I'm motivated by the exploration, by the journey, by the giving, but also the receiving, because I grow so much through it. So in terms of impact, I believe it has a place and is finding its place, has always, found its place. And it feels like that there's a continuing interest in that. But I kind of, it's a strange thing because I don't have that, manic ambition of just wanting people to hear my work because my work is so important, it needs to be heard. I kind of feel like I've moved beyond that point. And, it's a strange thing because the more I move beyond that point and the more I kind of let go of it, I find the more people start hearing the work and finding it. It's like the less attached I am to any notion of success, the more the work seems to find its own way. And that's lovely, I make my living, part of my living through my creative life, but also part of it, doing other work that I then put into my creative life. And so it gives me the freedom not to be defined by production companies or labels, even though, like the last album's out on a label, I work with production companies, but I'm not defined by anyone else's voice. And, I think that ultimately, part of, what I like to put out in the world is this sense of having a DIY ethic, having them, trying to think for yourself, trying to challenge your own thoughts and your assumptions. And when you have an idea, just go for it. And, one of the lines in the first documentary, which is called Exile Equals Home, is just sometimes you have to press record and see what happens. And I think that's sort of very much my philosophy. You keep rolling, you keep going, and hopefully love in the face of fear.
That's, I think, the perfect conclusion for our conversation. As the very end, I would like to play one more of your songs. Do you have a suggestion?
Well, I think you mentioned Obstacles. So yeah. I think that those are two sort of twin parts of the album. So maybe Obstacles would be a good one.
Okay, let's do it. Thank you so much, Jim, for your time. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you, man.
Okay, and this is Obstacles.
Looking at the obstacles in my way, it reminds me I'm so safe. I can see the dam that I gotta breach. It is high and hard to reach. Don't you know that I've been dreaming? Don't you know that I've been searching? Every day through the ups and downs I find I am alive. Listen to fire.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.